Welcome to our new series of bonus episodes of Hot Off the Wire called Behind the Headlines. These periodic episodes feature experts, journalists, and newsmakers offering their perspective on a specific topic. I'm Terry Lipschitz, senior producer at Lee Enterprises, and your host for this episode. An 1835 treaty between the Cherokee Nation and the United States that led to the death of thousands on the Trail of Tears included a provision that would allow the Cherokee to seat a delegate in the U.S. House of Representatives. Nearly 200 years later, the Cherokee have renewed calls for Congress to honor the treaty and seat its delegate. But what would that mean for the Cherokee Nation, as well as other tribes not covered by that treaty? What issues would a delegate focus on as a non-voting member of Congress? Our guest today is Dr. Julie Reed, an associate professor in history at Penn State University and a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, who recently wrote an article for The Conversation called "Cherokee Nation Wants to Send a Delegate to the House. It's an idea older than Congress itself." Dr. Reed, can you talk a little bit about that article and the history of the discussion?
One of the points I wanted to drive home in that piece is that Indigenous diplomacy didn't just come out of nowhere when Europeans and later Americans came on the scene, that Indigenous nations had been dealing with each other in a whole variety of ways long before they dealt with Americans and Europeans. And so there were a variety of practices already in play. The Chickasaws, the Choctaws had a system known as the Fannie Miko system, whereby actually young children were selected to go live amongst the neighboring tribe in order to kind of learn about that community and later become a kind of important go-between between those two tribes. So there are these systems in play that when European settlers arrive on the scene, they're stepping into those diplomatic practices already. And so there are systems in play, and the French actually conform to the Fannie Miko system and are kind of willing to send people to live amongst the Chickasaws in order to make things go smoothly in trade and diplomacy and all of these other pieces that keep people in peaceful times, right? And added to that, there are ways that we need to think about that are older systems that morph. So throughout the 18th century, Cherokees and Muscogee Creeks were kind of constantly embattled. But over time, they are also tapping into a system of diplomacy that had existed. And later, the Ridge, who becomes known as Major Ridge, is known throughout the kind of removal period, winds up serving on the Muscogee Council in a both advisory role, but also in a role of diplomacy. So how do we get these two nations back on track? We have people that come and sit amongst the councils in order to offer thoughts on major issues that are facing the community, but also to be a spokesperson to go back to the Cherokee community to kind of say, here's what the Muscogee Creeks are worried about. And Americans are, you know, they aren't ignorant of these systems. In fact, there was an added effort to have John Ridge, Major Ridge's son, thrown out of the Muscogee Creek Council and wants him usurped from that council because they don't want Cherokees influencing Muscogee Creek politics. And so, again, there are these longer histories that both Euro-Americans are stepping into, they're conforming to them, and they're aware of as they're entering their own diplomacy with Native nations. And so beyond that, I also wanted to show that we kind of see early pieces and treaties where there are these two systems that are kind of coming at each other. You know, that there are these older systems of diplomacy, and yet you have the language of delegates that is entering into play, particularly as the United States is kind of born. So the very first treaty with the Delaware, the very first treaty with a Native nation, has this potential for a Delaware delegate if a native state is ever formed, that the Delaware delegate would be the person that kind of acts as a spokesperson for other indigenous nations. So there are, again, you kind of see these elements of both indigenous diplomacy kind of coming and merging in a hybrid system kind of coming out of these early treaties. And the Cherokees follow suit. So their first one of their earlier treaties with the U.S. also has a delegate provision. But the provision that we're all talking about right now is the delegate provision in the Removal Treaty of 1835. So you know, we have to stop and think that these delegate provisions have already been included in other treaties, both with other tribes like the Delaware in an earlier Cherokee treaty. And so this isn't a new piece of potential piece of legislation that's being added in, but it is a firmer piece that's added in. So the language is more clear that should the Cherokee Nation ever want to send a delegate to Congress, that Congress then can make room for that delegate to arrive. So I think all of those pieces need to be taken into account, that this isn't just something that's being imposed on Native people. It's also coming out of Indigenous diplomatic systems, and that Native peoples are looking for the kind of best pieces of that diplomacy to devise treaties that also work to their advantage. So there are kind of sophisticated thinking about these systems that are building on, again, Indigenous diplomacy, but are also attempting to incorporate some pieces of Euro-American diplomacy that can work to tribes' benefits.
So why has this kind of re-entered the news now? This is obviously a treaty that took place more than 100 years ago, but really in the latter half of 2022, it began to pick up some steam in news conversations. What is the driving force behind this now?
Cherokees have pretty much had people in Washington throughout the 19th century, that there were constant delegations going to Washington, D.C. well into the early 20th century. We often, you know, need to remember that removal was a pretty devastating moment demographically. It's also a moment of ethnic cleansing, of Native peoples being forcibly removed across the continent. So there's a lot of rebuilding that has to happen after that. And that Cherokees weren't worried about a delegate immediately after removal. What they're worried about is getting their lives back on track. And then if we fast forward a little bit, we have the American Civil War breaking out, which dragged Native nations back into kind of this larger battle that was peripherally connected to Native peoples, but that ultimately divided Native peoples really along the lines of removal divisions all over again, another demographic disaster. Then if we fast forward a little bit further, arguably even more economically devastating is the allotment of Native lands, particularly in places like what becomes Oklahoma, where the communal lands are handed out to individual families. And what that led to was wide-scale graft. Lots of Native peoples ended up leaving Oklahoma, going all sorts of other places to do itinerant labor. The Cherokee people were plunged into poverty. And we have more policies to come that are kind of devastating in some other kinds of ways. So it has really been since the 1970s that the Cherokee Nation has kind of been in a revitalizing moment where the economic situation has changed. There has been a continuity of leadership. We've been electing our own officials again since the 1970s, because really from statehood until the 1970s, the federal government chose our leaders, not Cherokee people. So if we think about 1970 to now, it's really not that, I mean, I'm a historian, it's not that long a period of time. And if we look at kind of where the Cherokee Nation is at right now, they're finally in a place that there's some stability in communities, there's an economic diversification that's happening, there's some job building programs, there's some stability that using gaming revenues in our communities to kind of reinvest enables us to push some things that maybe weren't the priorities since the 1970s. The priorities have been housing. The priorities have been food programs. The priorities have been job creation. The priorities have been making sure that our local families are getting the things that they need, that their lands are being protected. And so again, if we create this kind of priority list, the delegate probably wasn't at the top of that list. Now, I would add that internally, the delegate conversation has been happening for a very long time. So I remember discussions amongst leaders in the late 90s, early 2000s. And there was some discussion about, is this the moment, right? Like, is this the moment we push for a delegate? And ultimately, I think leadership decided that wasn't the moment. But Chief Hoskin has said, well, we might be in a moment where we can have this conversation and it will be received, and it has. I mean, we've had a congressional hearing, which is the furthest we've ever gotten with this issue. Are we going to get to the finish line? I don't know. But there is a way in which I think we have to remember that conditions have to exist both within the Cherokee Nation, but also politically for the Cherokee Nation to kind of press for this potential delegate to the House.
Do you think the headwinds are there now to get this pushed over the finish line to actually happen this time?
That's a good question. Obviously, the House has just changed parties in terms of who has the majority, right? And so, I mean, I want to add a caveat that like Republican and Democrat don't always matter when it comes to policy as it relates to Native people. So to suggest that a Democratic Congress might have got this done, but not a Republican Congress, I don't want to suggest that. But we are in a transitional moment where we don't know what this new configuration will lead to. I think the conversation has already started, though. And even before that, there was some support, obviously not just from Democrats, but from Republicans as well. So it's unclear, it's unclear at this point where we're at. And of course, as we continue to have this conversation, I think there's going to be larger conversations that lead us to think about this in some broader ways than just a Cherokee Nation delegate.
Now, a lot of folks may not even realize that there are non-voting members in the House of Representatives, because every state has a proportional setup and has at least one member of Congress that votes for legislation. But we also have non-voting delegates, such as those that come from District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and some of the other places that, they're not states, they're territories of the U.S., and they'll send a non-voting delegate. What types of advocacy or policies do you think that this member would look for?
That's a good question. So obviously, I think there will be kind of bread and butter issues that a Native delegate would kind of constantly be tapped into. So again, paying attention to any legislation that's coming down the pike that could impact, say, Indian Health Services funding, or housing programs, or transportation. I mean, again, these kind of roads, what's going to happen to roads in Native nations? What's going to happen to the kind of delivery of medical care within Native communities? I think those will be kind of standard places that delegate would want to be having a conversation. And I think ultimately that would be good for most Native nations, because these are issues that plague Native nations across the country. But I also think we're having some other kinds of conversations right now that could be interesting as well. Obviously, the Violence Against Women Act has to kind of constantly be discussed and thought about. And that this has been an issue that I think has been a part of the conversation for a little bit now, in terms of we're thinking about the jurisdictional black holes that often exist in Native communities for the prosecution of both domestic violence and rape. And so I think that one would continue to be something that a delegate would pay attention to. I think we're also having larger discussions about energy policy in this country, and I think tribes have different relationships to the energy industry. I mean, if we're thinking about gas pipelines moving through Indian country, I mean, Oklahoma is one of those places where lots of pipelines are moving back and forth across those lands. But beyond that, I mean, I think there's been lots of discussions of fracking in Oklahoma and its impact on Native peoples. There's been discussions of water quality, that many of these things are impacting Native peoples who are still using water sources in culturally relevant ways. And so if water is harmed, then it's harming Native peoples more broadly. So I think there's some obvious places that any delegate that's in there is going to pay attention to.
The delegate, now this would be for the Cherokee Nation, but at the moment would be the only tribe that would have this kind of representation. Are you aware of any other pushes or interests from other tribes that are looking to, you know, send a delegate as well?
So, I mean, we should stop and say there are three federally recognized Cherokee tribes. One is the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians based out of Cherokee, North Carolina. The second is the United Gadua Band based out of Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And of course, we have Cherokee Nation also based out of Tahlequah. The UKB, United Gadua Band, has already seated it's put forward a delegate and says, hey, listen, we're signatories of this treaty of 1835 as well. So why is only the Cherokee Nation getting a delegate when we are also the descendants of these same communities and these same treaties? Eastern Band has also said, well, hold up, maybe we should have a delegate too. So it's prompting a kind of Cherokee question, right? Like, who in fact are the descendants of these treaties, and what rights are available to each of the three descendant Cherokee communities? The Delaware have had discussions about whether to move on some of their provisions. I mean, I think that Indian country broadly is having this discussion, and I've seen it in my own community as well, that like, well, why not every indigenous, why not every federally recognized tribe in this country? What, you know, there are 575. I mean, there's some practical issues. Sure. But I also think we've had larger conversations about like, how representative is our house if we were actually right, truly doing what we should be doing relative to representation, right? So we've had, I think there are discussions about, we probably should expand for better representational purposes, but we don't have a room that big, right? So I think there is like the big and most liberal approach to this would be, well, why doesn't every Native nation have a representative? And then I think there are kind of more, legally based questions around treaties of like, who actually had these provisions? Mm. What do they actually say? And who are the inheritors of these very specific legal provisions? And I think that's a different kind of conversation, mm-hmm. but I think Native nations are having all of them. We're having all of those conversations.
Yeah. So, well, let's just use the Cherokee Nation then as the example, since this is the one that's been in the news and the biggest discussion has been around this treaty and this discussion. So let's say the tribe is able to seat the delegate, and that's the only Native tribe that actually gets this type of treatment. On one hand, it would seem to become a powerful type of spokesperson for Native people in general, but obviously every tribe has its own agenda. There's different issues. I mean, we have obviously representation across the country from different states, just because regionally there's different policy interests between, you know, a Delaware or a Connecticut versus Wyoming or Montana or California. So how do you think that would play into just even getting a single delegate into the House?
I think this is a place where we probably have some thinking to do generally, right? Like, what does this mean? So, so one of the discussions has been our current delegate, Kim Teehee, has been picked by the chief. And so there is this question of like, well, should this person be elected? And so should this be an appointee or should it be by election? I think that's an interesting conversation that we probably need to have at some point. It's like, well, how should these delegates get picked? I mean, UKB is also actually, their leadership has selected their delegate, again, not through an election by the people. Added to that, I think we are polarized as a nation right now, right? Politically, I think there are some interesting questions about the power that would come with that, that would be different. I mean, not that our chiefs aren't powerful spokespeople for our tribes. I mean, I absolutely think the Cherokee Nation, because of its historic place in both American history, but also we're actually taught about in the public schools, unlike many tribes who get no love in K-12 education, that that Cherokee Nation understands that it has a role to play as a spokesperson, both for Cherokee Nation, but also for Native tribes more broadly. But that doesn't mean that this doesn't change our, you know, that if we continue with a selected delegate, what does that mean for our principal chief race, right? Like, what does that mean for our elections? Which I don't know that we have the answers to that, but I think that's something we have to think about, right? Is how does it change our national elections as Native people if this is now the person who chooses our delegate to go to Washington? I also think, you know, that there potentially could be a lot of questions about, like, how do other Native nations get the ear of our delegate if there is a pressing issue? That's interesting. I mean, I'm not sure what it means, but I think it's an interesting conversation to have. It's like, normally our delegates represent the interests of our state or of a portion of our state. And so what does that then mean for the Cherokee Nation? And of course, representation is not without its problems. It's not as if every delegate that gets elected represents everybody in that state or their interests or their political views. I mean,
sure.
So to suggest that the Cherokee Nation delegates should somehow be fully representative of all Cherokee people is an impossibility, just as it is for our representatives in Congress more broadly.
Have you heard, we talked a little bit about the change in leadership in the House going from Democrat to Republican, but obviously this isn't necessarily a Democratic or Republican issue. It's on a whole another level. Since the change in leadership, though, have you gotten any sense to where this currently stands? Has any progress been made? Is it still kind of just, you know, in a discussion point right now?
So I think that, you know, at least, again, speaking for what's happening in the Cherokee Nation, there is still a push to kind of both activate many of us as citizens, right? So I live in Pennsylvania, but I'm a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and vote in tribal elections, but that I can easily get on the phone with my representatives and here in Pennsylvania and say, hey, I'm a Cherokee citizen and I'm in favor of this delegate and here's why. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's that's still happening. You know, there's a texting campaign going on. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of agitation behind the scenes of, like, how do we activate people to put support forward? And so that's a key piece. And I know Kim Teehee is still in Washington as our delegate, doing the work of trying to kind of keep the conversation being had, so that it's not the momentum that we had in the previous legislature continues, and that the conversation doesn't have to stop. I think we also have, you know, a documentary record created at this point of those hearings, mm-hmm. that now kind of set a precedent for continuing that conversation. So, you know, that I think it raised questions for a lot of our Congress people that they hadn't really thought about before, right? That there are some Congress people that are like, I hadn't even really thought about this issue. And so now it's in their minds and they know they have to keep thinking about it. So, I think there is still momentum. And I think the fact that, say, the Eastern Band has set the issue of the delegate as one of their 2023 priorities. Again, the UKB has put forward their delegate. So from the perspective of the three Cherokee tribes, there is still momentum on this. And there is going to be a pressing of this going forward. So I think the conversation is going to continue. As to the House having another hearing, I don't know. I mean, the House is busy doing, you know, debt ceiling. You know,
right.
I mean, they're it's unclear to me what those policy agendas will be from this new House, which is, you know, I mean, again, unsettled at this point.
When we spoke offline about a week ago, we were just talking, and this is kind of an interesting piece of our conversation, I thought, especially since there's always TV, movies, there's a lot of, like, revisionist type of alternate history type of discussions and science fiction type things out there. But when we spoke, you had mentioned that the Cherokee Nation actually had a discussion with the Confederate government back in the 1800s about seating a delegate. What can you talk a little bit about that? It just was kind of an interesting side note to history.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The Cherokee Nation was actually the last of the five tribes to form an alliance with the Confederacy. And at the time, John Ross, who was the principal chief, who had also been principal chief during the removal crisis, did not want to see the Cherokee Nation get involved in the American Civil War, wanted to take a position of neutrality, really wanted to stay out of this, saw this as an issue for the United States, not one for the Cherokee Nation. And he was also a pragmatist and also had his own concerns within the Cherokee Nation, that the Cherokee Nation had actually been, I mean, I refer to it in my own writings as a civil war in the post-removal period, that it literally tore the nation apart and led to violence that really didn't resolve itself in 46. And so the agent who was serving the Cherokee Nation and some of the other tribes at the time wound up leaving the Union to serve the Confederacy. So he understood what the prevalent issues were and concerns were and drives were of the five tribes, and so was able to offer these incredibly generous treaty provisions. If you sign with the Confederacy, here's what we will guarantee you should we come out of this ahead. And one of those features was a full delegate to Congress. So not a non-voting member, not a fully, now, you know, I mean, we can speculate about whether, given some of the other things we know about the Confederacy's attitudes toward people of color, whether in fact that provision would have been honored. But it was arguably the clearest articulation of a delegate for Cherokee people at that point. And so so it stayed, again, kind of in these discussions. But the Civil War, again, ripped the Cherokee people apart again. And so after the Civil War, the Cherokee Nation usually sent three delegates. So they were three-person delegations sent on our own dime. And some of that was just, I think, built out of the fact that the Cherokee Nation had literally been torn in two twice. And just the idea of having one person vested with all that power when the nation is healing itself and reconciling back together was probably not realistic to just send a single person. So, I mean, I do think this is an interesting footnote to history. You know, again, I think if we're playing around with like what ifs, it's unclear. Right. I mean, it's unclear. We can't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on that note, we'll end there. Dr. Reed, I really appreciate your time in providing this perspective and coming on the show.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Behind the Headlines episode of Hot Off the Wire. You can find us on every podcast platform, and we'd love it if you could take a moment to subscribe and leave a review. Finally, if you appreciate what we're doing with this program, we encourage you to invest in local journalism by supporting the newspaper in your community. I'm Terry Lipschitz, thanking you so much for listening to this Behind the Headlines episode of Hot Off the Wire from Lee Enterprises.